Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Tuesday, March 31st, 2015. In an historic hotel, the scene of the breakup of the Ottoman Empire, the talks continue past the deadline with Iran. I'm speaking to you in the noon hour Pacific time, so it's about 9 p.m. in Switzerland, and from all the accounts I have, the talks continue, and the New York Times is reporting that it's likely they will be extended beyond the midnight deadline, at least into April Fool's Day. And that is, by the way, observed worldwide, at least in many different cultures, so we have to be on guard for unexpected developments or chicanery there. But it does seem that the Obama team is determined to come away with some sort of a deal, even if it's only a partial agreement. And as you know, I'm a sharp critic of Obama and John Kerry's foreign policy. This is the one initiative that I fully support, and I would like to see them succeed. And they are facing so many cooks who have inserted themselves into this kitchen determined to poison, to spoil that proverbial broth. And it boils down to, I guess, a couple of remaining issues from what I can decipher here. One is the rate at which sanctions would be lifted if Iran agrees to this deal. And the other stickler appears to be the existing nuclear stockpile in Iran and whether that would be shipped out of the country for processing in Russia or elsewhere. And, of course, all of this occurs as verbal snipers are operating from virtually every direction. The Saudis are trying to upend these talks for their own purposes. The Friends of the Nation of Israel in the United States and elsewhere are determined to stop this agreement from taking place, even though they don't really know what it contains. And with the ascension of Chuck Schumer likely to replace Harry Reid as the Democratic leader in the U.S. Senate, that friend of Israel, a guy who doesn't have a peaceful bone in his body, in my humble opinion, well, I think that we are even at greater risk for a shooting war with Iran in the very near future. Now, according to The Guardian, there may be a political framework statement issued in the next 24 hours. Any publicly declared points of agreement on important issues such as Iran's future capacity to enrich and the lifting of sanctions would represent substantial progress at the high-stakes 18-month-long negotiations. And the foreign minister of Russia, Sergei Lavrov, left the talks Monday, and he flew back in today, saying that he says the chances are great. As long as none of the participants in the negotiations tries to raise the stakes. And that is a problem that we've seen where the Americans are often driven by Israeli interests to move those proverbial goalposts. And these talks continue as Saudi Arabia, under its new King Salman, is really flexing its regional muscles, even pushing back against its major ally, the U.S. of A. So the Saudis are leading airstrikes against the Iranian-backed faction in Yemen. That backing, of course, is more rhetorical than real, but that's the way it's projected. They're backing a blitz in Idlib, Syria, by jihadists, including al-Qaeda-related people from the one of the groups there. And they're also warning Washington not to allow the Iranian-backed militia in Iraq to grab too much of Tikrit. So the Saudis are pushing very muscularly and They are having an impact in the region. We'll get to the conflict in Yemen here in just a moment. But I'm looking at this story from the New York Times today. The proposed nuclear deal would trade relief from economic sanctions on Iran for insurance against the risk that Iran might develop a nuclear bomb. But many Arab analysts and diplomats say that security against the nuclear risk may come at the cost of worsening ongoing conflicts around the Middle East, yes, using conventional weapons. There are no treaties, there are no talks underway to restrain the Iranians in any of these hot wars that are all the result of American policy blunders, in my opinion. So in Yemen, where a bombing campaign led by Saudis killed dozens of civilians in a strike on a camp for displaced families, the Saudis accuse Iran of supporting the Houthi government. And the Times notes, accurately, Western diplomats say Iran has provided money to the Houthi movement in Yemen, but does not control it, and there's no indication that they've received any arms. So, again, this is a lot of PR, a lot of a lot of demagoguery being aimed at Iran at this critical stage of these negotiations. And so it raises important questions about actually who are the allies of the United States in the Middle East today. Israel is off the rails. The new Saudi king is charting a separate course. Egypt, under its new dictator, is part of this pan-Arab military force. And so on the one hand, as I pointed out yesterday, if the U.S. can offload some of the military requirements in the Middle East to these other nations, even though they're run by dictators and they don't have our interests at heart, there is the short-term possible gain to the United States. But as I pointed out yesterday, there is this array of Sunni dictatorships and authoritarian governments that is getting more militant, more aggressive, and they all bought their arms from the United States. It is a really frightening time. All right, here's another item. Saudi Arabia's foreign minister at the meeting in Sharm el-Sheikh, the Arab League conference with 22 nations over this past weekend. In the closing comments, the Saudi foreign minister accused Vladimir Putin of Russia of hypocrisy and fanning tensions in the Middle East. And the Russians had sent a letter, and Putin stating that Russia backs the Arabs' aspirations for a prosperous future and the resolution of all the problems the Arab world faces through peaceful means, without any external interference. But then, the Saudi foreign minister, Prince Saud al-Faisal, said, well, they speak about tragedies in Syria while they're an essential part of the tragedies befalling the Syrian people. By arming the Syrian regime above and beyond what it needs to fight its own people. Well, the hypocrisy in this call of hypocrisy is overwhelming because the Saudis have been funding and arming the rebels in Syria for 5 years now. And some of their covert operations, including the use of chemical weapons in a way that was blamed on the Assad government, remain of serious concern. And so we have double and triple games being played. The U.S. claims that these are our allies. But the Saudis continue to behead their wayward citizens, even as we deplore the use of decapitation by Daesh, the so-called Islamic State. And the news of the latest hot war, the one in Yemen, Saudi-led naval forces imposed a blockade on Yemen's ports as airstrikes continued. This all aimed at the southern port city of Aden. I've heard it pronounced Aden as well. The move to block ports appears aimed at preventing the rebels from rearming and comes after the coalition achieved full control of the skies and bombed a number of rebel-held airports. And so this conflict continues, and one report indicates that the collapse of Yemen is very close. And I'll remind you of the history. That the last 5 years, the Obama administration has treated Yemen like a toy, like a playground, where we can conduct drone strikes on Americans, on Al-Qaeda-alleged militants. We pulled out one dictator and put in a guy we thought was more friendly to the U.S., and now he's on the run. And this is not a Bush war. This is all Obama's fingerprints. And one Hillary Rodham Clinton, I would submit. Meanwhile, in Iraq, the other hot war zone in that region, Iran's Revolutionary Guard claims that two of its advisors involved in the campaign to retake Tikrit were killed by an American drone strike, and the U.S. very strenuously denies it. They said we didn't have any drones in the sky over Tikrit on March 23rd. That must be somebody else's drones. Well, the CENTCOM statement is coalition forces initiated airstrikes near Tikrit on March 25th, 2 days after the alleged incident occurred, and no airstrikes were conducted in or near Tikrit on March 23rd. But they tell us that U.S. reconnaissance operations began around March 21st, 2 days before the alleged incident. We don't know if those reconnaissance drones had Hellfire missiles on them or not. And so this is just another thorny issue. And I certainly wouldn't want to be President Obama in this current situation. It would gnaw at me that my own misjudgments and miscalculations and aggressive war-making in Yemen are now threatening the one positive initiative of this administration in foreign policy, the talks with Iran. And with Israel going rogue on the Obama administration and elected officials on Capitol Hill tilting toward Israel and against our own president, these are perilous times. Extremely perilous, in my opinion. And I see so many efforts to distract the American people from what's really going on, and our failed government in Washington is stoking the war fires, stoking the amplification of war drums, and we will be left with our mouths agape. And I fear that's going to happen very soon. I hope I'm wrong, but that's the way it appears to me. Every day I like to pause to thank the people who support my work here with your subscriptions. Julie Anders just renewed her annual subscription. John Dickerson and Gary Batterson carry more of a load than they have to. Thanks very much. And Jason Ferguson is a longtime monthly subscriber. I invite you to join them, and I need you to do so. My ranks of subscribers have shrunk a little bit recently, and I need you to pick up the slack. So come on over to peterbcollins.com. Under my picture on the homepage, there is the link that says sign up. That takes you to a page where you choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers earn a gift from me, the bonus book, the ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's newest, called Empire of Chaos. You remember Blackwater, the mercenaries who have wreaked havoc and carnage in U.S. occupation zones around the world since 9/11? Well, there's a new tally of how much money Blackwater's successor company, called Academy, has made trying to fight the expansion of poppy cultivation in U.S.-occupied Afghanistan. And since 2002, Academy, before that Z and before that Blackwater, they have scored more than $500 million from the futile Defense Department push to eradicate Afghan narcotics. This according to a great report in The Guardian from its U.S.-based correspondent, Spencer Ackerman. Statistics released Tuesday reveal that the rebranded privacy firm reaped over $500 million from the Defense Department, 32% of the $1.8 billion in contracting money the Pentagon has squandered on this useless effort. And in December, the United Nations reported a 60% growth in Afghan land used for opium poppy cultivation just since 2011. Yeah, those mercenaries have been very effective. It's a real efficient use of American taxpayer dollars. We have a result in the election in Nigeria, and a former military ruler who last held power almost, 20 years ago, has defeated Goodluck Jonathan. And if we can impose on the legacy of Edward R. Murrow, now we can say good night and good luck, Jonathan, because he is out of there. He lost by about 2 million votes. And the victor, Muhammadu Buhari, was military dictator of Nigeria 20 years ago. He was ousted in a coup, spent 20 months in jail. I'm sorry, he served for 20 months, then he was ousted in a coup and spent time in jail. This is his fourth run at the presidency since 1999, and because of the unrest due to Boko Haram in Nigeria, it looks like they were looking for a strongman instead of good luck. Here in the U.S., there are a number of things developing. Activists who are opposed to dark money in political campaigns, those are the unlimited contributions that are funneled through phony nonprofit groups in an effort to obscure the donors. Well, one way that this could change is if the chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission, Mary Jo White, a hyped former prosecutor, would actually do her job. She has the right to force corporations to disclose any political spending that they engage in. And I'm a shareholder in a couple of companies that have spent money on political campaigns that directly contradict my interests. And I really bristle at that. But I only find out in the annual report a year or two after they've actually spent the money. And so Obama appointed this Mary Jo White character. She's got a real tough, tough image. And so in a clever campaign that you can access, I'll put up a link to it at whereismjw.com, activists from Public Citizen and other groups are calling her out. They're saying Mary Jo White is the superhero we need to end this menace. And then another onlooker shouts, "Where is Mary Jo White?" So follow the link and check it out. There is a, how can I put it? It's a silent animation that wouldn't do any good if I played it here on the podcast that you can watch at the link that I will put up to the site in the show file for this podcast. So the ad campaign comes in advance of the SEC's spring announcement of its rulemaking agenda. Under the former chair, Mary Shapiro, the agency had included a political disclosure rule on its 2013 agenda. But Mary Jo White removed the rule last year, and we haven't heard much about it since. In Boston, the prosecution has rested in the trial against the younger of the Tsarnaev brothers, Jokhar. And it's been a really weird trial. Of course, the investigation itself has been strange from the get-go. And the best coverage I've found has been from our friend Russ Baker and his team at whowhatwhy.com. And I will link to their latest dispatch from the Boston bombing trial. And what it identifies is the way the government has been permitted to change its story, shifting it to provide support for different themes that the prosecution has advanced. And so the fancy footwork has had the government denying evidence it once claimed to have possessed, and also at different points it has said that the pressure cooker bombs were sophisticated devices or not so sophisticated, depending on what argument the government was trying to promote. And I hope you'll read the article because it details the shifting testimony in important ways. And there are other issues, too, about whether Jokar was given his Miranda rights properly. It appears he was interrogated for 2 days before they bothered to do that. And it also begs questions about black powder residues in the apartments the brother the apartment that the brothers shared. And also there are important questions about whether outsiders provided help, like in creating these pressure cooker bombs. And as Who What Why has pointed out, the defense is not going to pursue these issues because they're not interested in exposing the truth. The simple goal of the defense lawyer Judy Clark is to keep Tsarnaev alive and to win a life sentence instead of the death penalty. And the cost of that is we may never know the answers to important questions that the journalists at Who, What, Why have raised, and curiously, most other outlets haven't even bothered. Great credit goes to the intrepid Brad Friedman at bradblog.com. Brad is quite a resourceful investigative reporter. And you may recall that last summer we reported to you that Judge Mark Fuller, who had been on the Alabama bench there and presided over the railroading of former Democratic Governor Don Siegelman, who still is rotting in federal prison, Mark Fuller was accused of domestic violence by his second wife. Her name is Kelly. Kelly was formerly his court clerk. And the relationship between Kelly and Mark Fuller led to Mark Fuller's divorce from his first wife, Lisa. So the judge and his second wife, Kelly, were at the Ritz-Carlton in Atlanta. She made a 911 call saying that she was in the middle of a domestic dispute and she needed an ambulance. We're going to play that call for you here in just a second. What is remarkable is that Friedman's reporting has caused the attorney for Judge Fuller, a guy named Barry Ragsdale, to try the judge's case or plead his case in the blogosphere. I find this quite unusual. And so Ragsdale has been accusing Friedman of inaccurate reporting, and Brad is very careful, and he details, I'll link to this story so you can read all the details for yourselves. But Friedman writes, in March, Ragsdale reportedly told the LA Times that Kelly Fuller, upset by what the attorney describes as an imagined affair, now this is a potential deja vu. Kelly Fuller reportedly thinks her husband, the judge, is now having an affair with his current clerk, just like the two of them did a few years ago. So, again, Ragsdale says that because of this imagined affair that she believed the judge was having with his law clerk, she attacked him while he was in bed watching television. And Ragsdale says that Kelly threw a glass at the judge and then rushes at him while he is lying in bed, before he then reaches up defending himself and grabs her by the hair and the shoulder. Judge Fuller, according to his lawyer, then stood up, throws her on the bed, she rolls off onto the floor and got a bloody lip. He never intended to hurt her, according to Ragsdale. But these are just assertions coming from a lawyer who's an advocate for a defendant who happens to be a federal judge with a lifetime appointment who is struggling to avoid impeachment or a reprimand from a judicial board that is reviewing his case. So there's more to it here, where Friedman details the claims by Ragsdale that there was only a single physical altercation, that it happened prior to the 911 call. And I think that it's fair to say that the lawyer's account is faulty in many respects. Now, Brad Friedman, to his credit, got the Atlanta Police Department to release the entire 911 recording of the phone call that came from Kelly Fuller on August 9th, 2014. Here it is.
Atlanta 911 operator 6342, what's the location of your emergency?
Someone's hot room.
Okay, what is your address?
I think I'm in 918.
What is the address?
I'm at the Ritz-Carlton.
You're at the Ritz-Carlton?
Yes.
What room number?
I think I'm in 918.
What's going on? Excuse me?
Domestic dispute.
Okay, with yourself and who else?
I'm calling. I need help.
What's your name?
Kelly Fuller.
Okay, do you need an ambulance?
Yes, please.
You need an ambulance, too?
Yes, please.
Hold on.
So this is kind of strange because the operator now calls for an ambulance and tries to get Kelly herself to order it.
Ready, EMS, address of your emergency.
Kelly? Okay, she needs an ambulance. I'm sending the police. They're in a domestic fight now at the Ritz-Carlton.
What's the
181 Peachtree?
Please help me.
With the Ritz-Carlton? Yes.
Is there a room?
918. She thinks she's 918.
918. Okay, what's your operator of?
6342. Yours?
I'm 783. And what did she say?
She said that she's in a domestic fight, and I can hear him hitting her now.
Oh, okay. That's okay.
Okay.
So that's the full call. It's interesting because when the operator asks Kelly Fuller who's hitting her, she dodges the question. Then, while the operator is talking to the ambulance dispatcher, you can hear Kelly Fuller saying twice, "He's beating on me, he's beating on me." And the operator hears that and tells the ambulance dispatch that he can hear the woman, the complainant, being beaten. So this is a rather dramatic and remarkable piece of evidence, and it is certainly not mansplained away by attorney Barry Ragsdale. Kudos to Brad Friedman for great reporting. Now, I must confess, I'm not the biggest fan or user of the Twitter machine. It's a business based here in San Francisco, and I've always found it a little weird. I don't like to communicate in 140 characters, at least not on a routine basis. But I do tweet a post every day about the new podcast or podcasts that we have released, and I occasionally, when I'm bored, look at my Twitter feed. And if you follow me, I apologize for not tweeting more often. But it does come with a price. And Trevor Noah, who just yesterday was announced as Jon Stewart's designated successor on Comedy Central's Daily Show, is already coming under fire for some tweets that he has made. And Trevor Noah is an established comedian in South Africa. He reportedly has 2 million Twitter followers. And he's tweeted some, you know, stuff that I wouldn't tweet. He makes fun of women who are fat. When a woman is loved correctly, she becomes 10 times the woman she was before, so she gets fat. He's made jokes at the expense of Jews. Almost bumped a Jewish kid crossing the road. He didn't look before crossing, but I still would have felt bad in my German car. Then he said in 2010, South Africans know how to recycle like Israel knows how to be peaceful. Now, I'm not particularly offended by that last comment. And comedians try to be edgy, they try to be funny, and often things that are funny in a moment don't appear so even a day later, much less 4 or 5 years later. I'm interested, though, in the modest or mild reaction of Abraham Foxman. He is the fiery director of the Anti-Defamation League, and instead of demanding that Comedy Central remove this guy, Trevor Noah, before he even sits down at the anchor desk, Foxman said, "We understand comedians often use humor to poke fun at stereotypes and to push the envelope of political correctness, and it seems that many, if not most, of the tweets sent by Trevor Noah over the years fall into these categories." Well, I've never seen such a diplomatic comment attributed to Abe Foxman. And Noah himself, who is not in the country, we're told he's in South Africa right now, posted and then deleted a tweet earlier this morning. Quote, "Twitter does not have enough characters to respond to all the characters on Twitter." Now, that one is actually pretty good. And finally today, I want to share with you a bizarre crime story from here in the San Francisco Bay Area that is getting weirder every day. So last week, on March 23rd, the town of Vallejo, which is east of San Francisco, it's a blue-collar town, the scene of a former Navy base called Mare Island. And there was a report of a kidnapping. A 29-year-old woman who was pregnant, she is the mother of one with her boyfriend, and had just learned she was apparently going for an ultrasound treatment later on the day that she was kidnapped. And her boyfriend and the father of her kids, Aaron Quinn, was the one who made the police report. But he said that she was kidnapped in the morning. The report didn't come in until early afternoon. He said he had been drugged by the kidnappers. Now, the details of the kidnapping are pretty rich. It's almost like a TV crime story. And the couple reported that they were required to put on headphones. Guns were pointed at them. And then the male was drugged, and the female was hauled out of there and kidnapped. Then the San Francisco Chronicle began receiving emails from people who purport to be the true criminals here. This kind of reminds us of O.J. searching for the real killer, right? Well, the first email went to the Chronicle on March 24th, and it contained a digital file with proof of life, a recording, from the woman saying that she had been kidnapped but was otherwise fine. Then the kidnappers made a demand for only $8,500. And then they dropped off the victim at her father's home in Southern California below Long Beach. Now, in the meantime, the boyfriend got a lawyer who said that he was a victim and the girlfriend was a victim, and the police have blamed this couple for what they consider to be concocting some sort of a false report. Well, now there is a second email from the real perpetrators, or the people who claim to be the real perpetrators. This one is 9,000 words long and was delivered by email from a Hotmail account, to the Chronicle last Saturday. And it has numerous details of the kidnapping and also an apology. We dropped Ms. Huskins off at her dad's home in Huntington Beach because it was more or less equidistant to the Bay Area and because we were horrified at what we had done. The real perpetrator says that they made a mistake. It was mistaken identity. They kidnapped the wrong person. They went on to say, as an effort to prove their bona fides, that they have been conducting burglaries and other crimes in the Vallejo area for some time now. They remain unidentified, and the silence from the Vallejo Police Department is deafening. And so it appears that there are some real criminals out there, and that the Vallejo Police Department has so much egg on its face that it can't really get out of its own way to track down this email account, huskinskidnapping@hotmail.com, or maybe get the NSA and the FBI involved to find out what's really going on there. I'll continue to follow this story as it twists and turns and keep you posted if it's really interesting. Thanks for listening. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.